Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curls on Film podcast. This week we'll be discussing Joe Stevenson's documentary McKellen, Playing the Part, and we'll be hearing from our special guest and the subject of the documentary himself, Sir Ian McKellen. I'm Sam Howlett and joining me this week are regular contributor Irena Musumeci.
Hello.
Hello. And making her pod debut, we are joined by producer, curator, student of theatre and performance and knower of all things Shakespeare, Rowan Rutter.
Hello, that's very generous. Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome. So before we discuss the film, as always, we ask you to let us know what you think about the films we talk about on the show. So I have a few Twitter reviews of Michael Pierce's Beast to read out. At Born to Pootle says, Beast, if you want moody and dark, it's a feast helped by impeccable casting of leads. Loads of people stayed after the credits had played to bask in the atmosphere of the film. At Ang Martin says, it's wonderful, Jesse Buckley is phenomenal, art direction gorgeous, and saw this in a weekend in a tiny rural cinema in France. Sounds brilliant. And then at Lydia Palmese says, I'll be flabbergasted if this isn't my film of the year. It's likely to be one of my all-time favourites. I loved it so much that I came and bought a ticket for the very next showing, which is a personal record. So high praise indeed for Beast. And if you are interested, we did our show on Beast a few weeks ago now, where we spoke to the writer and director, Michael Pierce. And as always, you can have your review read out on future podcasts on Twitter or by emailing us on podcast@curzon.com.
All podcast reviews are required to have internal rhyme. Like,
yeah.
Beast is a feast.
that was great.
Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah,
I didn't realise that until I read it out as well.
Fantastic delivery. I think Ian McKellen would be proud of you, Sam.
Well, before we get into our film of the week then, let's just talk about how we first encountered Sir Ian McKellen.
Yeah, I think probably for me, the first time I encountered him was on film, playing Iago in the Trevor Nunn Othello. Mm-hmm. On film as a child, sort of sitting at my mother's knee. And then it's just a voice that stays with you, isn't it? And you and it sort of peoples so much film and so much theatre and increasingly television as well. That it sort of becomes a soundtrack, I think. So I don't think there's any one moment that would particularly stick in the memory, although I do remember being in the green room at West Yorkshire Playhouse, which I think must have been in 1998, which he refers to in the film when he was in Leeds working. And we had a very serious conversation at the chocolate machine about how the double-decker was the king of all chocolate bars. And I'm not a huge proponent of chocolate bars myself, but going forward in my life, if there's a choice to be made, it's always a double-decker.
Endorsed by Gandalf.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
The king of chocolate bars. Irena?
Well, I first came across Ian McKellen in a book when I was a very young Shakespeare fanatic in Italy. Mm-hmm. I was given this beautiful book called Shakespeare in Performance, which had an illustrated history of all sorts of different canonical performances, I would say, of Shakespeare on the British stage. And there was a picture of Ian McKellen there in Trevor Nunn's unnameable play, which we shall not refer to. And his face was so captivating that it kind of stuck with me. And fact that his eyes looked so hollow and yet so magnetic and were communicating so much. And in I think about 3 or 4 years later, since getting that book, the film of Richard III came out, and then I recognized the same actor. And it was really that moment in the opening scene when he's giving the opening speech of the play, and he turns around and says, "I can smile and murder whilst I smile." And I thought, okay, he's the greatest. This is fantastic. And then I became very interested in his work from another book, which was a book about... it was written by a psychiatrist who had helped bring some Shakespeare productions to Broadmoor. And Broadmoor being the criminal psychiatric hospital in the UK, where sort of fairly famous, infamous, rather, serial killers and rapists and murderers of various different kinds and ilks were inmates. And the RSC brought a production of Hamlet, in which Mark Rylance played Hamlet, and a production of King Lear from the National Theatre, in which Ian McKellen played, I think, Kent. And he wrote the introduction to this book, talking about the reasons why they wanted to go to Broadmoor and tap into sort of communicating Shakespeare with people who had had experiences like the ones you see in the play, people who've killed and who have done horrifying things in King Lear. You know, there's eye gouging, there's rape and murder, war, death of all sorts. And it was just incredibly compassionate and very interesting. And I read this shortly after seeing Richard III, so I wrote him a letter. He, at the time, maintained a website, which was quite, you know, accessible. There was a forum there, and he responded to people, and I wrote him a letter saying how interesting I found this experience in Broadmoor. And he wrote back saying, oh, yes, it was, you know, an incredible part of his career, and he was still, he would love to do some more work like this, and sort of was very candid about it and really brilliant. I didn't expect to get a letter. Yeah. I was 14, I think, and he sent back an autographed picture from Richard III, which was up on my bedroom wall, and I was a bit starstruck, I think, at that time.
Amazing. Do you still have the photo?
Yes,
great.
I do.
Yeah. I'm very much more from the kind of film angle of Ian McKellen. I remember going to see Lord of the Rings when I was however old when that first came out, and then X-Men. So I'm very much, it's quite interesting that we got sort of three very different kind of perspectives to him. So I'm proper like blockbuster Ian McKellen, I guess. But I have since discovered the Shakespeare Ian McKellen, the theatre Ian McKellen, and then some more sort of quote-unquote prestige films Ian McKellen, like Richard III, like Gods and Monsters.
Oh, yeah.
He's definitely walked many different shoes, I believe, in his life.
It's interesting how he straddles all these different fandoms.
Yeah.
Because I think largely they don't intersect.
No.
But then some people really find actors like him a gateway into various different things. Like for me, I was already hooked on Shakespeare, and suddenly I discovered film and I got into that. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of people, I guess it's the film, and then you discover the stage. So it's fantastic to encounter performers like this. And it's rare. It's rare to have actors who can straddle the two worlds
so
effectively.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about what you said is that you use the word blockbuster in relation to film. And as you go back and look at his theatre career, you realise that so many of his performances in the theatre were also blockbuster performances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at his sort of catalogue of roles, and you have Macbeth, you have Hamlet, we're not in a theatre, I can say it. you have King Lear, you have, I mean, but also you have roles that aren't sort of the sexy and well-known ones, like Edward II and King John.
Yeah.
And then Amadeus, which of course he was... you know, he won awards for, and then Chekhov and these enormous roles which he just sort of takes in his stride, and I think that's the real measure of the man.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of the man, it's time to hear from him. So we're talking about McKellen Playing the Part, which is a feature-length documentary about the life and work of Sir Ian McKellen. So we have access to private photo albums, a wealth of never-before-seen archive material. We're showing diaries here when he was younger, unseen behind-the-scenes footage of theatre shows and films. It covers everything from his upbringing to becoming a theatre star, to when he came out and became a leader in the gay rights movement, to his film stardom, everything from Magneto to Gandalf, and his personal thoughts of everything along the way from acting to old age and even death. I had the distinct pleasure of speaking to Sir Ian McKellen a few weeks ago in London. Enjoy.
Okay, so we are delighted to be joined on the Curzon Film Podcast by Sir Ian McKellen. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Nice to be here.
So we're here to talk about Ian McKellen playing the part.
Oh dear, are we? Must we? It's very difficult talking about a film which is all about oneself, you know.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
I'd rather say I'm here to recommend a film by Joe Stevenson, who's the director,
yes,
and asked me all the questions, and it's sort of through his inquiries that you filter me.
So you say in the opening, one of the opening lines is it's very difficult to be yourself.
Hmm.
But this is a film all about being you being yourself. I mean, how was the interview between you guys?
That is the puzzle, you see. If you're having your photograph taken under any circumstances, whether you've gone into a studio, or you just got your degree and you've got your mortarboard on and your gown and your scroll, or whether it's just a snap, a selfie, what do you do? I mean, how do you arrange your hair? Do you smile? I mean, there are people who all say cheese, smile for the camera. Why? Being yourself is a very difficult thing to be, except one is oneself all the time, or a different aspect of oneself. And so this film rather explores that problem. But I can guarantee, having seen the film, that the person you see there is me. He sounds and looks like me, and he speaks and thinks like me. So I hope it's a little bit like meeting me for the first time, and me being a bit indiscreet about a few things.
So what were your first thoughts when you were approached about this documentary? Was there a sense of, like, were you flattered that someone wanted to make a film entirely about you, or were you a bit nervous about all of that information being out there?
I think probably I said to Joe that this film will never be seen, will it?
Yeah.
It's just an exercise we're doing to see whether it's possible. I'd seen his first feature film, Chicken, which I thought was quite remarkable and very entertaining and funny and moving and everything you would like a film to be. But so I was confident that he would, making his first documentary, do something original, and so it proved. I had no idea when we were making the film, and no idea until the very moment I saw it that other people would be involved, and some of my best friends play real characters that I mention in talking about my life. They don't look like the real people, but they embody them, and so you get a sense that I do belong to a community, and I'm not just on my own. Spouting into the wind.
And there is a lot of archive footage in the film, I'd say. It's like largely comprised of this archive footage.
Yeah.
And there's one moment where you talk about how when you looked back at yourself in one of your early TV appearances, you say, I was not impressed at all.
Oh, no.
Are you quite critical of yourself sometimes when you look back at certain pieces of work?
Well, I relate it again to being photographed. If you look at old photographs of yourself, you say, which one is me? Oh, my God, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
What am I wearing? What's that funny hair I used to have, you know? And it's a bit like that, but multiplied by 100. I spend my life pretending to be somebody else.
Mm.
That's relatively easy. We can plan it all out with the costume designer and the makeup designer and the director and the lighting man. Together we create something. But here I am on my own. And I've lost track of the question now.
It was about if you're self-critical. When you see a performance.
Yes, so seeing a film is 100 times worse than just looking at a still photograph of yourself in a photograph album. And of course you'd do it differently now. But of course there's no point in saying that because you're too old to go back. And if I know anything about my career, it is that I've got better as an actor as time has gone by. So of course, if I see myself in an early film, I cringe. I'm not the only actor to say this.
No,
many actors won't even see their own work. Well, I see each of my films at least once.
Of course, okay. So how long was the actual interview between you and the director?
I think it spread itself over 5 days.
Wow, okay.
Many, many hours.
Yeah.
So this is a cut-down version of the highlights. Joe has very kindly cut out the grumpy moments when I said, "What the hell are we doing? Stop it!" You know, I'll need a cup of tea or something stronger. So, but I suppose what happens over that length of time is that you do relax and you get off guard and start speaking as far as possible as yourself, and there's an intimacy and relaxation which is appropriate to this sort of exercise.
I heard an interview a few years ago where you said you were considering writing a memoir.
Yes.
Would you say maybe that this film could act as your memoir?
Well, perceptive of you, because it was just before this that I decided not to write my autobiography. I'd been asked to, and I'd agreed to.
Yeah.
I had a huge advance ready to slip into the bank account, and as I started imagining what the book would be like, the problem for me was that I couldn't work out who I was talking to, who I was writing it for.
Right.
Was it the Gandalf fans or the people who like me, like Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Or the Northerners? Or the gay people?
Yeah.
Who am I talking to? I don't know. You can see the problem. If I put RSC, anyone who goes to the theatre a lot knows that's the Royal Shakespeare Company, but some people won't know that, and some people won't know who Shakespeare is, or what it means to be royal, or in what sense is it a company. So, I thought in the end I'd be writing a dictionary rather than a biography, and telling stories about oneself to some people is appropriate, and telling the same story to somebody else would be. So, I just found it too difficult, and then I found it upsetting in an unhelpful way to go back not to my birth but to my conception and imagining what my young parents were like just before the Second World War. What were they doing having a baby? Was this a world to bring a child into, and were they aware of that, and what were their feelings about it? And they're both dead, I can't ask them, and I can't fictionalize it, and yet it was something I wanted to think about. And in the end, it was all too difficult for me, and it was just at that point that Joe said, "Why don't you talk about yourself for a few hours,
perfect.
And we'll put together the story."
Yeah.
And I thought, right, to filter it through somebody else's questions, somebody else's point of view slightly, it would be the best way to do it.
Yeah,
so I think it's the closest I'm going to get to a memoir.
So there's a point in the film where we look at when you wrote and produced Richard III.
Yeah.
And it struck me as interesting that you've never written or produced a film again after that. Was there a reason? Did you think I'm never doing that again, or was there like attempt to do it, or do you think you still could do it?
I felt I could do it in that case because I'd been played Richard III on stage for the National Theatre in the UK and abroad.
Yeah,
I knew it very well. I was a party to the production, the treatment of the play by the director and designer, and the fun was imagining what was cinematic about our approach and whether it could work on the big screen. And so I wrote the screenplay, and then was on my own because the director Richard Eyre was busy running the National Theatre and couldn't have any more to do with it. So there I was suddenly finding myself as a producer, having to go around Hollywood and raise funds and enthusiasm, and that took me 2 years. And then asking friends like Maggie Smith and Jim Broadbent and subsequently Robert Downey Jr. and Annette Bening to be involved for very little money. And although I'm very proud of the film, and it goes on looking good, I think. The BFI recently put out a cleaned-up version of it and sent it around the world, and audiences responded positively, but, oh, my God, do it again? No. No, thank you. I'm not cut out to be a director, a producer. And I learned earlier on in my life that I wasn't cut out to be a director. I did a little bit of it and did some plays in London. No, my talent is, and my experience is, and my expertise is acting.
Yeah.
Whether it's for the screen or on stage. And Yeah. The rest I'm very interested in.
Yeah.
But no more.
There's a really there's an interesting moment where we see some behind the scenes footage of Return of the King, where you ask Peter Jackson something along the lines of, why is my character doing this, or what does this have to do with the story? And he says, oh, don't worry about it, like, it's fine, I know what I'm doing, kind of
yes
thing.
He knows what he's doing. Yes.
And I was just wondering, do you think it's particularly difficult for a theater actor to then enter a film set where you perhaps have less control over your character?
Yes, that is the crucial difference. Yeah. In the theater, but after you've rehearsed it and prepared it with the director, he or she goes away.
Yeah.
They might drop in, but on the whole, they're replaced by the audience.
Yeah.
Now you're doing it for them. And you're doing it night after night, and you're discovering still how to do it. So you're if you're working hard, the last time you play the part will be different and, let's hope, better than the first time. Cinema, you're doing this scene just once today in a variety of ways, close-ups, long shots, mid shots. Yeah. Camera behind you, all that. You'll do it many, many times, but it'll be an amalgamation of what's been captured by the camera that the director will put together, and it will be therefore his performance based, taken out of the raw material that the actor's given. So, film is the director's medium, and theatre is for the actors. And uniting both, and supreme, from my point of view, is always the writer,
right?
The person who wrote the script, the person who wrote the play. That's why you're doing it. It's their message, their story, and you're at their service. Mm. And if you mistakenly think that you're more important than the words you're speaking, then you're in problems, I think.
Yeah.
So trust is a very important thing, and almost before deciding that I really want to play a part, I have to know who's directing it and are they going to be able to tell the story.
Yeah.
I trust Peter Jackson. I've learned to do that very early on.
Yeah.
It would not be to his advantage to make me look foolish or act badly.
So I think there's an assumption for some people that for theatre actors, doing these Hollywood films is a kind of sense of one for them, and then I can go back to doing a smaller personal play. When you made Lord of the Rings and X-Men, was there ever a sense of that for you, or were you, is that kind of a too sort of simplistic way of looking at film and
theatre? Well, I've got Catholic tastes as an audience. I like all sorts of things. I like big adventure movies. Yeah. I like small dramas. I like comedy and tragedy. I like pantomime. I like musicals in the theatre. I like Shakespeare. I like the classics. I like new stuff. It's all thrilling if it's well done.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I want to be in all that variety of storytelling that there is available? And so I've been in Coronation Street for 10 episodes. I've played Widow Twankey, a drag part in the Aladdin, on two occasions. I've done a lot of Shakespeare, done new plays, and I've now been in big franchise movies and small independent ones. Mm. So it's all the same to me.
Yeah.
Because and what's the same about it is that it's all different. There are some people, we call them stars, who are always the same. You don't want Cary Grant to be different. You don't want Elizabeth Taylor to be different. She must always remain the same. But Ian McKellen, where's he going now? Well, he's going, having a good time and enjoying himself and discovering things. And if you do a variety, then you're likely to get better at the job. Yeah. And my job is to fit in wherever possible. And so I've still got a musical to do. I haven't done one yet. All singing, all dancing, perhaps on ice. Hmm.
There we go. That's your next project. Ian McKellen, thank you so much for your time.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ian McKellen there in what was possibly the highlight of my life.
it was a pretty brilliant interview.
Yeah, he was so incredible.
Generous and warm.
Yeah, and I think there was something really nice he said during the interview about, as you just heard, as I asked him about the fact that he's never written a memoir and that this film kind of is his memoir. And he said the reason for that is he wouldn't know who to write it for because there are so many different kinds of Ian McKellen fans, which is what we were talking about before the interview just then. That, you know, there's so many different people bring so many different things to him, and he gives so many different things back. And he's very generous with his fans as well, like your story about the photograph. And I remember my friend from school had, you know these kind of like making of film books. My friend had like the Lord of the Rings visual guide, and he bought it in once. And inside, he opened it up, and there was a photo of him with Ian McKellen signed and everything.
Wow!
So I think that just shows you how like generous he is. And I actually now have my own photo of me and Ian McKellen.
Oh,
to rival his.
Can we put this on Twitter?
Absolutely, I'll put it on Twitter. Really? It's going to be everywhere, don't worry. So I wanted to start with the beginning of the documentary where he says, I'm paraphrasing here, something along the lines of, everyone is playing a part. It's not yourself you offer to the world, but a role. And I think this documentary has a really quite almost subtle way about talking about the nature of acting and the nature of being constantly in the public eye.
Yeah, I think the quote that struck me, which is I think in a similar vein, was, I don't really have an image, I'm an actor. Those are my edges. Beyond that, I try to be myself. And I think working in the theatre and spending time with actors, there is a constant battle between what is real and what is reality. Those two things are not always the same. And what is performance. And also the great and huge exhaustion of giving a false performance, or not a false performance, a performance of not yourself, and then having to walk off stage and be yourself at the same time as shuffling off that performance. And I think that's a really interesting idea. There's a speech in Shakespeare's As You Like It by Jacques that famously begins, "All the world's a stage," and goes on to say, "And all the men and women merely players. One man in his time plays many parts." And I think, for me, that's what McKellen is getting at there, that there is this constant push and pull between the man, the actor, the performer, the part, but also then the private, the domestic, and the public.
There's also a neat distinction between different kinds of actors, which he himself highlights, and he says, from a star, you don't want to see them being different. When you go and see a big star, you want to see them being themselves. You want to see that sort of fake authenticity. To have certain actors bring themselves to a role, whereas there are others who completely change from role to role. And I think McKellen is such a fascinating performer because he does both things at the same time. It is always recognisably Ian McKellen, and yet each part that he has played is a different character. And that is fantastic. When he said, he says something about how he walks differently in each part. So many directors work on actors walking and characters walking. And there are directors, there's a director called Katie Mitchell who always said that she's always interested in what actors' feet are doing on stage because that tells you so much about a character. And McKellen is always an actor who goes into the details in such a brilliant, brilliant way. So it's fascinating because his work is almost in the realm of the character actor, and yet he's a leading actor. He's played all the big parts. He played Richard II very, very young. He played Hamlet. He's done all the big chunky roles, and even in films like Lord of the Rings or The X-Men, where he isn't the lead, inevitably it's his character that stays with you because it's so 100%. Memorable.
Yeah.
But what you were saying about the private and public sphere is also fascinating in terms of himself talking candidly about his own life and his personal experience. I found the sections in the film about his childhood really, really interesting. And there were two things that struck me. One was when he talks about his sister, who is 5 years older, and he says something about how it was clear that she was in a club and that Ian McKellen wasn't allowed to be in that club. And I think so many actors start like that. Mm-hmm. So many actors see that there is a club somewhere and they're not part of it. How can they be part of it? How can they be in another club? And they find the space in the theatre, because the theatre is particularly an environment of great community, I think, still, even these days, when the workings and the politics of theatre are so different from what they were at the time. And I think that'll be interesting to discuss. But then he also talks about his sort of split between private and public when it comes to the idea of his coming out, which came quite late in life at a time when it was not a traditional, normal thing to do. And it was quite a stunning. He was 49. Yeah. Quite a stunning political gesture to make. Yeah. I think he was probably the first really significant public figure.
And such a low-key way of doing it, that phone in on the radio.
Yeah.
I thought that was astonishing footage, actually.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, Ian McKellen, the person, and Ian McKellen, the activist, meet. Mm. And that is such a great, there is such a great mission to his work today still, which is wonderful.
Absolutely. And yeah, this isn't quite on the same level as some of the other things he was doing for gay rights, but I remember when I had the X-Men video. This is how long ago we're talking now. And after the film finished, so this is before DVD, so you couldn't select the making of. This would just play after the film if you happened to leave it on. And he was there in an interview talking about why he picked the role, and he spoke about it as a gay man picking Magneto. Mm-hmm. He said about the fact that the sort of the struggle of the mutants in the X-Men universe spoke to him in terms of the struggle for the LGBT community, you know, trying to be accepted within the world. And even I remember thinking that's a really interesting, the fact that he's even then, he's still committed to this kind of cause, to this aspect of himself that he wants to promote.
That is fascinating. There's always this element of kind of the outsider to his performances as well, which connects with both his ideas, you know, the club that you can't be into and the club that you're not into because you perceive yourself as different, which is something he says a number of times about his childhood and how he was aware that there was something, but he didn't know what it was. There was, you know, a change in his sexuality, how he was not interested in girls and possibly would have had a different relationship with his father in particular had he had a girlfriend to bring home, which I thought was a really candid moment in the interview.
It's not just his performances that are about otherness, it's the parts, you know. So many of his great parts are roles in which the protagonist is outside of the world in some way or another. And I think just picking up on what Irene was talking about in terms of the club and the inside and the outside and the private and the public, and Ian McKellen the man or the actor, there is one, I think it can all be sort of encapsulated in one particular thing that he does on camera, which is what I sort of call the McKellen wink. And he does it in almost every performance. And it is a way of allowing his audience into his world and saying, come on, you're with me. And I let you in. I allow you to be part of this journey. And it is extraordinarily generous. Now, it's sometimes generous and disturbing, as in the case of Richard III or Iago, and then sometimes it's Gandalf.
Yeah.
And there's this there's a generosity of spirit there that I don't in any way believe is just performance.
The disturbing nature of Ian McKellen's characters is has always been absolutely fascinating to me. After Richard III, I think the next film that I saw him in was Apt Pupil.
That's a very dark film.
It's a very dark film, and it's a film that kind of has picked up a number of increasingly dark associations to do with its director and its young star, Brad Renfro, who met a very untimely end. Very young, I think he was 25 when he died, and he was 13 when they filmed it. He looks about 17. And McKellen really does do that thing of, I'm allowing you in, but you're not going to know me as much as you think. And he in the film, he plays this sort of ex-Nazi who is living undercover somewhere in America, and this young boy with Nazi like tendencies finds out that he is nearby. He finds out his real identity and tries to kind of make him become his mentor. And it's the relationship between them is so disturbing.
Yeah.
There's really sort of elements of kind of grooming a criminal, but also rejecting the self. And I always found that film really, I don't know, just kind of compelling and disturbing at the same time. And it was really such an easy step from Richard III to that. And so much so that when he then played Magneto, I thought, okay, that figures. And yet Magneto has got this backstory that he's kind of...
Hugely tragic.
Hugely tragic. And it's amazing to me that it's the same actor performing those three parts.
So I think what's incredible about the documentary and something that's really nice is that it's all from McKellen. It's all him leading it. There's no talking heads. There's no. It's not like the director Joe Stevenson had this plan about how he wanted this documentary to go. It's all. So it's, I think it was a 14-hour interview with Ian McKellen he did, and then everything comes from what Ian McKellen says. So in a way, Ian McKellen is leading us through his life, rather than someone else leading us through his life. So it's in a way, it feels more like an autobiography than a biography. And I think that's really great to watch.
It's also a really good feat of editing. In terms of comprising that, you know, 14-hour conversation into this quite compact hour and a half look into the private and public sphere of this one man. I think where the documentary is most effective is where you have real footage of Ian McKellen back in the past and him reflecting on it and talking about it. There's a thing that he said at the end, after the credits, when there are little snippets, and he says he's asked this question: what do you wish young Ian knew back at the time? And he says, I wish he knew that he was attractive. And it's like, how can you not see that? It's really amazing. But of course you don't know. And, you know, it's one of those things, life can only be lived forward, but having the luxury of time and reflecting back on yourself must be such an amazing experience. I can see why he wouldn't want to write an autobiography after that, because it's really intense as well.
And I agree. I think the parts of it that I enjoyed most, because you can sort of luxuriate in it, is his recollections of Cambridge and touring, and you know, there's that moment. I think there's a gang of them out, you know, in front of a building on a football pitch, and there's a circle around Ian that says me, and then sitting beside him is Trevor Nunn, and then you know, and you think, oh,
Corin Redgrave,
gosh, yeah, Corin Redgrave, Derek, that, which Jacobi. Is, you know, the Redgrave dynasty. And you realise that they really were all there at the same time, and then you sort of understand, to use an overused phrase, but a kind of a golden age of British theatre in terms of what we think of. And I thought those were particularly effective. And also realising, of course, that Ian McKellen spent potentially about 7 or 8 years of his early life looking a little bit like Laurence Olivier, which is no bad thing. I think for me, it also, yes, a feat of editing. And I think Joe Stevenson says in an interview that he just couldn't include everything. So there were some brilliant anecdotes that had to go. I also think that within those 11, 12 hours that didn't make it, there are potentially some other things that I felt I wanted to hear, I felt were missing. And for me, there's a really interesting journey through the film that's about grief, that starts with the death of his sister Jean, and then he talks about the death of his mother when he was very young, and that was very sudden, and then the death of his father before he had come to a resolution with him about who he was. And I think grief is a really interesting thing in the theatre, and he talks about going to the funeral and then being on stage that night. And I think it's an element of performing that we often forget, that when we go in the evening and we've had a tough day, and he's very generous, he says actors spend, you know, the whole day relaxing, and then they give you their best 3 hours, and but they do, you know, have other things to do during the day, and he doesn't ever fully recognize, I don't think, the impact of his own life. And I think that is something that is shared often by actors, that the stage becomes an escape. And for me, I wanted the interview to go a little further into that.
A little deeper.
Yeah.
There's also the great unspoken section of the film is about the death of his first boyfriend, Kurt, who died of AIDS in the 80s. And he does talk a little bit about how so many losses and so much death is what brought him to the idea that he needed to be public about his sexuality and fight particularly against Clause 28, which was the Thatcher era clause against promoting, in inverted commas, homosexuality. And he becomes, you know, a new person, I think, out of that. But I agree, I wish I'd heard a little bit more about the personal experience of losing the person who was his first boyfriend. And he talks about how it was really his first relationship in which he felt that he could be comfortable, and in an environment in Cambridge where homosexuality was certainly tolerated, if not accepted, but in the theatre world where the rules are perhaps slightly bendier than outside of it in the 1960s England. But there is also something about, you know, when you say the golden age of theatre, it's also something that's really interconnected with the way the theatre system worked at the time, and the way certain performers and certain people, talent like Trevor Nunn, who is a legendary theatre director, really, who is, you know, his work has spanned from Les Mis to absolutely historic productions of all the big Shakespeare plays, and who was the artistic director of the RSC, together with another group of people in the same generation for decades and decades, and really created this culture. And it's a system that was allowed to exist because there was funding for it, because it was supported. So the notion that Ian McKellen, the young actor who had the opportunity to come to London and participate in the National Theatre Company at the Old Vic, as managed by Laurence Olivier, as he says in the film, the greatest theatre company acting troupe in the world at that time, but then decides to pull out because he wants to play the big roles, and he knows that he's going to get a chance to play the big roles in Leeds or in Birmingham, outside of London, has all to do with the rep system and the way theatre was organised at the time. And the fact that he says, you know, actors were given flats to live in. If you moved to Leeds, you had the company lodging to stay in, you had a wage, you could stay there and do a repertory season in which you could really develop as a performer and be in a Chekhov play, be in a Shakespeare play, do Ibsen, do a modern play. And the repertoire was so rich that a local theatre goer would have been exposed to productions of exactly the same quality as in London or Broadway, and a wealth of different voices in terms of playwrights and in terms of the topics of the play. And I think that's really something that's lost, and it's lost with our generation, with the golden age generation.
What isn't lost is that problem, because the problem of London versus the rest of the country is still very much alive. And I think what McKellen was talking about in terms of his changing his voice and his accent and stopping being a northern boy when he came to London, and Derek Jacobi and all the others who just sort of lost their accents along the way. This is still a problem that we encounter in the theatre, regionality versus London. But now we have a bigger problem, or we are having to face up to the fallout of some very problematic decisions that come to class, language, race, gender. Mm-hmm. And we sort of, we ball it all into diversity, but that's, you know, that's essentially what it is, and the money is still in London, and that's a problem. And what's really important about the story that McKellen tells in terms of taking this troupe of actors out into the world is that it's not possible anymore. And so it becomes a really important document of a particular time in theatre when a particular kind of activity could take place. And we, you know, that's, we need to hold on to that.
Absolutely, yeah. This is something that I had no idea about, this kind of, this part of the theatre world. And not only is it nice to see it in a documentary, but nice to hear it from Ian McKellen. I want to talk a bit more about the his sort of fight for LGBT equality in the film, because that's a huge part of it. Bigger than I expected it to be, actually, because obviously I knew McKellen the actor, but and I knew he was gay, and I knew he was very outspoken about gay rights, but I didn't know it to this extent, the very public way he came out. And
yeah, the fact that he sort of started Stonewall, I mean, not single-handedly, but I was watching it thinking that, again, kind of going back to where we started, this idea of the blockbuster, he just sort of, that was what he did next, and that's what was this huge success in so many ways of sitting around a table with eight other people, I think it was, and just saying, we need to do something about this. And I recognise my visual power in terms of being a name, and what I can bring to that. And again, you go back to that idea of the generous actor.
Yeah.
Is what part can I perform here that is helpful and useful and will drive this forward? And I thought that was, yeah, extraordinary. And then a kind of decision to self out.
Mm-hmm.
Again, really, really important to document those moments in time, because they are thankfully now decreasing, that people are having those moments where they have to come out or be outed. And I, you know, I think about really, really famous moment on American television where Ellen DeGeneres came out on the, I think, on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
I think it was on her sitcom.
Was it on the Ellen Show?
I think so.
Oh, and then Oprah interviewed her. And those moments where you kind of, you actually see, you sort of can physically feel and see the shift that someone has been able to and to enable because of whom, what they are, and that's very important.
And he's so eloquently spoken as well, the way he talks about it when he's on the chat show with the other, I think it's the, was it an MP who's debating him?
Oh my
gosh,
wasn't that an extraordinary piece of footage?
And yeah, and he's so relaxed, but so fired up at the same time, and it feels really rehearsed, but it obviously isn't. But it just feels so natural for him to talk that way, and
But that's about, I think, I wonder whether that was also about a kind of an actorly muscle memory of going, I know how to manage this. I know physically how to hold myself without showing my frustration or my anger, and I can find the words because I have a lexicon that I can, you know, bring up immediately or borrow. And I think, that's a really extraordinary piece of footage.
And how wonderful that he's still really active in the in this arena. You know, I had no idea that he's doing this tour of schools and talking to young kids about his experiences as a young gay boy and against bullying, and really having a very participant role in what, you know, his experience can teach us, which is fantastic.
And he does the "You Shall Not Pass" at every single school he goes to. Incredible. There's something, so the film ends on a interesting note where I think, so Joe asks him, what do you think about most? And he says, I think about death most, which is, again, as he's been throughout the whole documentary, very candid, very open. And that's not something you think an actor is often concerned with. I don't know, it just suddenly felt, no, it wasn't the answer I was expecting from him.
I remember when my maternal grandfather was dying, and he had a phone conversation with my mum, who is a Shakespearean professor, and he said to her about dying, you're going to really enjoy this. It's like being in a Shakespeare play. And I was thinking about that whilst listening to him speaking about death, and then kind of reflecting back on how many of his characters that he has played spend so much of their time thinking about death or pondering. You know, most of Hamlet, he's reflecting on the human condition and therefore the end of it and what might lie beyond that. The same with Lear and Macbeth, etc. And so again, I wonder whether if you have this extraordinary art that and portfolio that supports the idea of death through language and visual imagery that the theatre and performance gives you, that maybe thinking about death is quite an interesting thing and becomes much, much less terrifying.
Yeah.
There was no sadness about it.
No, there wasn't.
I thought it was really interesting. I always said, when you start thinking about death a lot, it means you're ready for it. Right. Which broke my heart, but he seemed to be so at peace with this idea. And I wonder if that's also a little bit connected with the fact that so many actors, particularly film actors, achieve a level of immortality. You don't really die. Yeah. There is going
to
be...
And that's probably why it shocked me so much to think of him as thinking about death. Because for a lot of us, actors are immortal. And we don't think of them as having, you know, a start or an end of their career. Their career goes on for us, I suppose.
Yeah, and also we can go back to, you know, reviving them and bringing them back. So they spend a lot of time dying in fiction. He dies in so many of his parts as well as thinking about death. But there's something to do with legacy that I think is really fascinating about this documentary and how he sort of does all of these activities. And he says, it's because I don't have children. If I had children, maybe things would be different. And yet I think, you know, how many children has he inspired? He inspired me when I was very young, 14. And I'm sure as many kids who've watched Lord of the Rings are thinking, wow, if I can be an actor, maybe I can be an actor like that. Yeah. And I think that's an incredible legacy.
Absolutely.
And it means you leave behind a different kind of child, you know, of your own creation and your own moulding.
I also wanted to quickly talk about this moment at the end where I think it's going for like footage they didn't use, and there's a bit where he's holding his phone next to his head and it goes off and he just gets terrified.
I thought that should be the opening scene of Ian McKellen the musical, which he sort of touches on, that is the last sort of thing that he really, really might want to do, or, you know, I just thought that would be great. But in that, I think is also that lovely thing that he talks about throughout the film about everything he does for strangers. And I was reflecting on that a little bit, thinking, well, every doctor in A&E or every bus conductor, or, you know, to some extent, everything all of us do is a presentation to strangers. But what it's not is a presentation of strangeness. And I think that's where the actor and the extraordinary depth of this particular actor really comes into full clarity and definition.
Absolutely. Do we have any lasting points?
So Ian McKellen has never been in Harry Potter. No. Of all the sagas that he's been in, that's the one. And I didn't realize that apparently when Richard Harris died after filming the first Harry Potter films, Ian McKellen was asked to play Dumbledore and he turned it down. Did you know this?
I didn't know this. Yeah.
So he talks about it very briefly at the end of the film. And it's funny because having got to that point, I was thinking, why was he not in Harry Potter? Literally everyone's in Harry Potter.
You also think that he is. That's the other thing. That
because so many people mistake him for Michael Gambon and ask him for autographs. But there's
older
a lovely,
man in white beard.
I can't remember where I read this recently. It may have been something to do in connection with Fantastic Beasts. But I hear that on the set of Harry Potter in Dumbledore's study is a picture of Gandalf. So
here we go, the two universes are colliding.
McKellen says that one of the reasons why he turned it down was because Richard Harris didn't like him as an actor.
Oh, really?
He said that he, Derek Jacobi and Kenneth Branagh are, quote, technically brilliant but passionless.
Wow.
How wrong is that?
Oh, there we go. So on Sunday, the 27th of May, there is a live event which will be broadcast into cinemas along with the film. It is a Q&A with Ian McKellen hosted by Graham Norton. So do check that out if you are a big fan of Ian McKellen, as we all are. If you feel like staying at home this weekend, on Curzon Home Cinema, we have Redoutable.
Redoutable.
Redoutable?
Je ne sais pas.
Which is Michael Hazanavicius's meta pseudo biopic of Jean-Luc Godard. That is out in cinemas and on Cousin Home Cinema. And also on Cousin Home Cinema, we still have Andrew Haig's Lean on Pete, which we discussed last week's show, and it's an incredible film, so do check that out. And Molly's Game as well is coming on Cousin Home Cinema, which was Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut. We never spoke about it on the show, but I actually really enjoyed it. And as ever, if you've got any thoughts on McKellen playing the part, or Lean on Pete, or any film we talk about on the podcast, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show. And if you like the show, subscribe, leave a comment and a review. We're available on iTunes and Acast. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you, Rowan Rutter, for making your pod debut.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Irena, as always.
Thank you very much.
And goodbye from me. See you next week.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.